This was a triumph. I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture Science. We do what we must because we can. For the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead. But there's no sense crying over every mistake. You just keep on trying till you run out of cake. Then the science gets done and you make a neat plan for the people who are still alive.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker. Yes, Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, and that funny song from Portal.
Yes, written by Jonathan Colton. Check him out on the internet. Awesome singer-songwriter.
He is. And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your philosopher and political science guy.
This is not Rob, because he is showing up late, but this is Daniel, economics student.
Well,
I'll say it. Rob, what do you... Oh, right, he's not here yet.
If at all.
Yes.
Well, I guess we can say that I'm here because I wasn't here last week. I was down on the weather, so...
Yeah, sorry to cut you off there, but how was the trip? We got Daniel's report. What did you think of the whole conference?
Well, aside from getting sick, it was great. I really enjoyed myself. I thought that the people in Toronto put on a fantastic job, and it was great fun. I think that probably the best part for me was just being able to sort of network with the other skeptical and humanist groups in Canada and basically make plans on the national level as opposed to sort of dealing with kind of the nebulous, you know, goals that we all set for ourselves. It was much more interesting to actually sit down and say, okay, well, we're going to work on this, and you guys are going to work on that, and, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to have a nice, you know, shiny new system that we're all going to be really happy with. And I think it was just really, really great. The talks that, Daniel, you talked about last week, so I won't sort of repeat everything, but I thought were really good. I really did enjoy kind of the back and forth of the archaeology talks. Mm-hmm. The first guy, you know, kind of a little fishy, but I thought... Dr. DeCarlile did a very good job of sort of countering his points, and I think he did it in a very good way. Like, he wasn't very arrogant and condescending. He asked questions and asked the person to sort of clarify what their talk was, and I think it was just really well done. And I think that sort of the takeaway that we can all take away from this conference, the big picture, is that, you know, the skeptical movement in Canada is strong enough that we can have our own conferences, we can have our own conventions, and I would really like to see, you know, an annual convention in Canada, you know, led by the groups in Canada, whether it's CFI or whether it's, you know, grassroots groups like Skeptic North or the podcasts that, you know, we know and love here. I think that we can really make something happen.
Actually, you know, someone asked me this recently, and actually maybe this is a good time with your new CFI connections and fresh from your Toronto trip, but We often are asked, I'm often asked anyhow, what is skepticism for us? And I believe we're going to be doing a talk soon, which we'll get into later, about what exactly is our form of skepticism. I mean, some people seem to think of it sort of as a form of nihilism, as opposed to what I would think of more of as scientific skepticism. But from your conference, what do you think their version of skepticism was?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, coming up with a good definition of skepticism is eluded everybody in the movement. I mean, I think it's really about sort of applying a simple methodology to everyday life, and that is simply, you know, not taking things on face value, looking at evidence, looking at, you know, what is the reasonable, logical, or simplest explanation for a given issue. And I mean, CFI is interesting because it has a wider scope than I think most skeptical groups. CFI also focuses on things like, you know, secular humanism and sort of cultural aspects. Like, for example, we mentioned the whole God and anthem debate, which, I mean, for an average skeptic, probably is not a big deal at all. But it does, I think, say something from a cultural point of view, that it talks about, you know, what kind of society do we have? And we've mentioned before on the show that Canada does not explicitly state in our charter and constitution that we are a secular society like they do in the United States. But at the same token,
don't tell Texas that.
Yeah, well, we'll get up to that in later. But I think that, you know, what this really does say, though, is, you know, the skeptical movement in Canada is a different breed. You know, CFI's take on things is to combine things, whether it's for dealing with homeopathy or alternative medicine. And we also want to look at things like secularism and, you know, things like God of the National Anthem and this ridiculous pastime of supporting religious schools with state money. You know, tax dollars should not be spent to support a religion that you do not subscribe to, or if you subscribe to any religion. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're Catholic or Jewish or what. You know, you shouldn't have your tax dollars being, you know, promoting somebody else's religion. It's just not fair and ridiculous.
No, actually, you know, and I would I would add on to that. I mean, I think most of our beliefs are sort of, you know, we believe in proportion to the evidence present. That doesn't mean I don't believe some things that are more or less without evidence, but they're weak beliefs and they can easily be done. And I think one of the things that our show has always done, which is why we've gone, I think, even broader breadth than your standard skeptic show, is we like to attack dogmas, things that people just sort of take on faith, mix my metaphors or not, and just say, well, you know, is there validity in that, or should we question it? Sometimes they're true, sometimes they're not. What do you think, Daniel? What's your take? Well, we've got the CFI, and we've got Ethan's view of skepticism. I kind of threw in my 2 cents worth. You're an economist, so obviously you must have some form of dogmatic beliefs.
maybe. No, I kind of agree with Ethan, and well, both of you said good things. Skepticism to me is simply making sure there's evidence or logic behind anything you believe in, and I understand to an extent that this is sort of impossible, and that in order to really function, you have to occasionally let this go a little loose. For instance, like in everyday life, you can't always be looking at the evidence behind everything. It's just too time-consuming, but in general, when it comes to big things, people shouldn't just blindly accept them. People should be looking for evidence. People should at least see some logic with what's going on.
I think actually that would be a good thing I'd like to hear from our listeners, all millions of them.
Yeah.
What does skepticism mean to you and all that? We're going to have a talk soon coming up at Skepticamp, and write us in at radio.freethinker@gmail.com at what skepticism means to you and what you think skepticism is.
Yeah, and let us know, like, what do you think of the definitions of a skeptic? I mean, is a skeptic necessarily a freethinker? Is a humanist necessarily a skeptic? These are interesting questions, and I think at some point they should be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have we sat there and we've had sort of a debate where you're sitting there and you're talking about, well, should evolution be taught in school, for example? And you're talking to a Christian who thinks evolution should be taught in school, and you sit there and from my particular point of view, I consider it sort of a form of cognitive dissonance. But, I mean, they're skeptic in the one sense. I mean, they believe in scientific method, they believe in all that. But, you know, again, you can be part, all, or nothing.
Well, I don't know, Daniel, what's going on in Texas? Are they having this debate as well?
Well, Texas pretty much has a constant battle with some of its Board of Education over whether good, well-supported stuff should be taught in Texas schools. The most recent attack on evidence in Texas has to do with history, so I'm sure Ethan will be interested.
I love history.
History and social sciences. I'll just go through some of the ridiculous things they plan on changing, and you guys can comment where you want. The first thing they want to change for God knows what reason is to get rid of Thomas Jefferson from the teachings of Enlightenment ideas of political revolutions. Thomas Jefferson, like the major founding father of the U.S., is being taken out of U.S. classrooms.
Well, no, that makes obvious sense because, I mean, the man supported counter-revolutionary beliefs, right? I mean, he insurgency against his own country. What else did he do? I mean, I bet you he was a terrorist. And I mean, obviously, this person should be denigrated in the United States.
I think the real problem is not that he was a terrorist; it's that he was a secularist and argued probably stronger than anyone else for separation of church and state. And if you look at some of the other things Texas is planning on changing, that seems to be what they're focusing on. And he was also a fierce critic of Christianity. He wasn't an atheist, but he did challenge the dogma of Christianity, challenge their morals, challenge all the mythical things Christians believed.
Jefferson, like a lot of the founding fathers of the United States, they were deists, right? And I mean, deists are, they sort of believe there was a God who got everything started, and after that, everything else follows by Newton's laws. They were very Newtonian in the mechanics of the universe, people of their date. But they believed in a scientific universe as opposed to a mythical universe. That the Bible should be read more as a moral tale than as a literal text of what actually happened, historical text.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just sort of speaking of morals and ethics, guess who just walked in? It's Rob.
Hello, it's Rob, cognitive psychologist, 10 minutes late for the show. My notes are completely soaked with water that I fell into a puddle as I was running here, and my phone is entirely out of batteries. How's that for the start of a show?
Well, that's the kind of professionalism you come to expect on Radio Free Thinker.
Yes, anyways, back to Texas.
Yeah, what else happened in Texas?
Well, they're no longer going to teach children that the U.S. was founded on the idea of church-state separation. This comes from sort of their radical conservative members of the board.
Oh, I heard about this. This is Texas taking over basically the textbooks for school children all over the states because Textbook is one of the massive textbook publishers for the states.
Yeah, basically because Texas has some of the most children and one of the... Yes, that was bad wording. They have some... They're one of the biggest states in the U.S., any changes they propose often end up in textbooks all across the U.S. So
it's cheaper for the textbook manufacturers to just keep it with Texas and, you know, screw the rest of the states.
Exactly. This is why I think what California is doing with their open source textbooks for school kids, it's much better. You can, you know, there's no costs for printing and selling the textbooks. They're online and everyone has access to them.
But going back to the separation of church and state, so they're not going to be teaching the American Constitution anymore? Because, I mean... Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that one of the amendments is the separation of church and state?
Yes. Freedom of expression is, well, that's freedom of religion, and there is another amendment.
That no law should be done to promote a particular religious belief.
They're basically just ignoring that. One of my favorite parts of all this is that they already teach people about, or teach children about the Constitution. Now what they're going to do is they amended that part to primarily talk about the right to bear arms. I mean, personally, like, obviously that's in the Constitution. I don't think they should ignore it. But on one hand, they're arguing that, like, children should be, like, fully taught their rights in the Constitution. but on the other hand, they're basically picking and choosing which of these rights to teach.
Well, and isn't it? Sorry, but I'm even more confused now because they're dropping Thomas Jefferson because he's a terrorist, but then they're going to promote everyone having their own guns in case they need to have insurrection. Because, I mean, that's one of the whole ideas. Everyone should be armed in case the government treads on your rights. So, only in Texas.
There isn't much logic behind it. I will give them credit for one small thing, which I'm sure some of you might disagree with me on, and I know a lot of the sort of left-wing blogs out there, progressive blogs, don't like, is that they are now not going to refer to the U.S. as democratic, but instead a constitutional republic. Why? Because the U.S. is a constitutional republic. It practices democracy, but it's not pure democratic. It's from day one been designed to limit the ability for a majority, which is sort of the democratic way, to pass laws for everyone else.
Well, in the Federalist Papers, I believe it was Hamilton who said that one of the greatest fears they had is that the masses might actually gain control of the government, and that would risk the land holdings of the elite of the country. But no, as the leftist on this podcast, I don't think that that's a big issue. I don't think the United States, I mean, let's remember, in the United States, they have indirect election of their president, right? I mean, they don't vote for president. They vote for people who in turn vote for president. So, yeah, that's perhaps reflecting reality, which again goes with our other thing about being skeptic. You can be skeptical in one area and totally bamboozled in another, so...
Which is a good place for a wrap-up, because I know I just got here, but I bet you guys have been talking back and forth about this for the past 15 minutes, right?
Well, why don't we go to a commercial break, and we can get Rob up to speed on what we do on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And so we're talking about Texas. Let's shift gears a little bit. Talk about just sort of general religion. And I saw a really interesting story in the Vancouver Sun about a new study that was done out of the U.S. that has tried to determine which religious group is the most wealthy, which I think is kind of interesting. The information...
Let me guess. So who's the religious one, right?
What's that?
Which religion is the richest? I said Scientology.
Ah, yes. Well, I don't know if the Pew Forum for Religious and Public Life considers Scientology a religion.
No one else does.
But we'll have to see, maybe in a revised study. They included 14 different faiths that are commonly found in North America. And so each faith was divided into five categories of income brackets, the highest being 100,000 plus. The lowest being less than 30,000. I don't know if that means a year or income or exactly what, but there's still, you know, I think a good guide of numbers there. So anyone want to guess which religious group had the most money?
Some kind of Christianity?
No.
Atheists?
No.
Oh, that was just a...
Wait, is this going to be
Shinto.
Like...
Shinto.
No.
The Jews.
Yes.
Ha-ha. Well, I'm cheating because I've seen this article, and there's actually a really good infographic someone made out of there. I'll link it for the show notes.
Yeah, it actually is pretty cool. So Judaism had the most members who are in the income bracket of $100,000 plus group. So the percentage is around 46%, which is pretty high, almost half.
Wait, 46% of Jewish people have an income over $100,000 a year?
Yeah.
Now,
I should become Jewish.
I'm sure that's how it works.
That's a good reason to convert, financial security.
but now I have to beg the question here. Now, I think we need to do more research into this, but this smacks of perhaps a bit of, I don't know, racism or something. I mean, some people are going to sit there and say, well,
You know, you're just reiterating a cultural stereotype.
It's a very good point, because we don't know. This study does not say, are we talking about religious Jewish people, or are we talking about culturally Jewish
people? Yeah, I was going to ask about, like, how devout are they? Are these people that go to, like, temple all the time?
Exactly. That information was not available. So
I might also point out, too, and you have the list in front of me, and I unfortunately haven't seen the list, but you mentioned there are 14 different religions. Mm-hmm. Now, Judaism itself is, there's Orthodox...
Yeah.
Reformist. Is that divided up? Because I imagine they have Baptists, they have, like, they've divided up the Protestant side.
They did. You see, that's another bias. It's divided up primarily from a Christian point of view. And we'll get into that in just a second. So I want to mention the second most wealthy group, and that is Hinduism. So they have around 43% of their members in the 100,000 plus group. So that's kind of interesting. I think that, you know, why are the, what are the reasons that Jewish people and Hindus have such members in such a high income bracket? And again, I suppose we could make generalizations that probably would be improper right now without further research. But I mean, I think it's an interesting question. Maybe our listeners have an opinion on that as well.
I would really like people to give us their non-racist ideas as to why do they think Hindus, Jews would be top of the thing? In fact, I believe the Pew Report, you can go online and do the, what's the full name for them?
The Pew Report, that is the Pew Forum for Religion and Public Life. We'll have all the notes in our show notes, so check them out. Also kind of interesting, after the Jews and the Hindus, there's a pretty big drop-off in terms of wealth. The next biggest is Orthodox Christians at 28%. So kind of interesting there. You know, I would have thought, you know, aren't
what is the size of these demographics? It could just be like a sort of regression to the mean, right? Maybe because there's so much more people within these little Christian brackets that everything sort of evens out and the average bracket.
That's a good point.
You might also have certain religions going after sounds kind of vicious, but primarily aiming at getting more members through lower income brackets.
That's a good.
A lot of churches offer social services primarily for, like Christian churches, social services primarily for those of lower income. So that might bring a lot more in, whereas maybe Jewish people don't really do that.
It's possible. I think it's kind of telling the poorest religion. By poorest, we mean the most members in the lowest income bracket of 30,000 or less are the historically black Christian churches, which I think is no surprise. I mean, from a socioeconomic status, that makes a lot of sense.
But then you
unfortunately.
Think, well, yeah. But you'd also think maybe they reflect, because you think that actually Catholics might be big, although the historical Catholics might be rich, because you think of the Irish who've been in the United States for a very long time. But, I mean, a lot of new immigration comes from Latino countries, which are very poor immigrants. So, again, I'd be really curious. We really have to revisit this topic again and do a bit more research.
Yeah, like, we've already talked about how it's biasedly split up more so for the different splinter groups of Christianity and all the other kinds of religions lumped together. We don't have any idea of the numbers or demographics. I mean, I worry that this study, which seems like it has a lot of data that isn't being incorporated into what we're seeing in the report,
yes,
and it's going to be used to sort of bolster racism.
Well, another interesting aspect about this, I mean, after sort of the predominantly black Christian churches, you have Jehovah's Witnesses. 42% of their members are in the lowest category. Then you have Muslims. And then you have evangelicals. Now, that surprises me, because when I think of evangelicals, I think of, like, you know, those mega churches with millions of dollars. And
well, the preachers, the evangelical preachers, have the millions of dollars. The people that go to those shows give all their money to the evangelicals.
But sort of getting back to what Rob was kind of mentioning, if the sample size for the evangelicals is off the charts bigger than, say, the sample size for Hindus, it would actually make sense that the numbers would be totally skewed in that way. Because if there's millions of evangelicals, there could be a huge amount of them that have lots of money, but because there's just so many of them, the numbers get skewed down so that it looks like they're one of the poorest groups.
You know, actually, now I think we talked earlier today about what is skepticism, and I think right now we're given a very good example of how skepticism works in mind. Ethan brought us this poll, this result, And we've sat there and we've accepted what he's said because Ethan doesn't lie to us.
This is the public service announcement portion of our broadcast.
But no, I think this is a great demonstration. I mean, you see how we're questioning it. We're not making any great claims. We're not saying it's wrong. We're not saying it's false. But we're questioning it, and our belief in the effectiveness is being proportionality to the evidence that we've been given.
Exactly. You know, and getting on sort of that vein, what I'd like to see this study do is I'd like to see it be reproduced, and I'd like to see it done in different countries, Canada, the UK, France, see how it factors out across sort of the industrialized West, so to speak.
We talked last time about cultural differences and how popular religion and what kinds of people were religious in Europe versus North America, for example.
Yeah. So I think there's definitely an interesting aspect to this, and I'd like to see more research done into it. It's a fascinating field, and I'd love to just to remind our listeners, if you have a background in sociology or economics or religious studies, please let us know what you think about this and give us your thoughts on it, and email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
UBC's International Week is March 15th to the 19th. Celebrate international perspectives and activities right on campus. You're promised to find something that will tickle your interest.
Attend a talk by renowned speaker Paul Rusesabagina. Fly by the cultural fair, have a bite at the food fair, or check out at the grand performance. Make iWeek a part of your week.
UBC's International Week, March 15th through the 19th. For more information, go to iweek.ubc.ca.
So we're back to Radio Free Thinker, and in my usual weekly trawling of the newspapers, I found a couple of stories in the Vancouver Sun. One that you may have heard about is this massive recall of HPV, which stands for hydrolyzed vegetable protein. And this one article from the Vancouver Sun, I thought it was interesting, not only in that it was talking about this massive recall, which some people are saying might be the largest recall of a food product ever done in North America, but also because of the sort of ridiculously credulous way that it was written in. It starts off with the very first thing you see in the article is, it sounds more like a chemical than a food ingredient. Well, hydrolyzed vegetable protein is, in fact, a chemical. All food ingredients are chemicals. They actually go on and describe later how hydrolyzed vegetable protein is made. And basically, companies will take veggie scraps and soy extracts, boil them in hydrochloric acid, which is then neutralized with sodium hydroxide. And this creates a bunch of amino acids. And that is, if anything, a very chemical process. So they're talking about the sort of separation between chemicals and food ingredients, which leads right into, in the middle of the article, about this, you know, whether natural additives are better for you than chemical additives.
So are natural additives not made with chemicals? Are they made, what are they made with if they're not made with chemicals?
That's just it. There's no actual legal definition that separates the two.
Yeah, no. So.
But HPV is actually found as a sort of powder in a lot of different foods. It's used in soup mixes, chip dips, popcorn seasoning, the powdery stuff on flavored chips and Cheetos and things like that. So it's in almost everything that you can find that has powders in it or is made from a mix at the supermarket. And one thing that I actually found was interesting was that the process of creating the HPV, it ends up with a bunch of amino acids, one of which is glutamic acid, which is the main flavoring ingredient in HPV. Now, glutamic acid is better known in its form as a sodium salt, monosodium glutamate, or MSG. And at this point in the article, they actually have an interview with someone who suffers from migraine headaches when he eats MSG. And they sort of once again spin it into this sort of like, oh, this is a horrible chemical, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, well, it's not actually MSG. It's one of the same amino acids that shows up in MSG, but it's used in a different way. And the problem with this one is not that it causes migraines in people who have a certain kind of epilepsy that when they eat MSG suffer from migraine headaches. The fact is that this one the plant was contaminated with salmonella, and that's why it's being recalled. But the salmonella isn't even mentioned until the last paragraph or two of this whole article.
So it makes it sound like the big reason for this recall is because it's a scary chemical, and not that it was infected by food poisoning.
Yeah.
You know, and you get that. You get such a conflation. I was just reading today about a decree in Italy where they've banned restaurants from using all sorts of additives because of the supposed risks of these additives, and one of them happens to be MSG, which is an interesting coincidence. But scientists are railing at this because there's no evidence for this. It's just a false thing. And to make it even more insane is that these restaurants aren't allowed to use these additives. But if they buy prepackaged food that have the additives in it, that's okay. So if they bring in Twinkies, they can use Twinkies, but they can't make them in the place itself.
So
but
not only is it not based in science, it's completely arbitrary.
Which again, I think just goes on to this thing. I mean, actually, I like this story because, I mean, I was mentioning this off air beforehand about this story, and I think it's a great thing because, you know, everyone says processed foods and all that, oh, they're evil and they're bad for you. And, well, sometimes things go wrong. And we had this plant that had a salmonella poisoning. But, I mean, there are methods now for dealing with this. I mean, they're doing their recall. It's a huge recall. But, I mean, it's not like the big companies are out there and they're out to kill you.
It's not like natural foods never have recalls either.
It's true.
Well, it gets to the point of, you know, you start to jump in shadows. It's like, you know, we had the maple leaf issue a year or so back. Horrible tragedy. People died. But it's not a symptom that happens all the time. It's one of these sort of rare, unfortunately horrible things that happen, and it's an accident.
But it gets huge media coverage and spreads all over the place.
Right. So we confuse it because it gets all this media coverage that it happens all the time. We forget that it doesn't only happens once in a while. Sorry, Don, go ahead. Sorry.
I'd be actually curious if we look back at some of the old issues of the Vancouver Sun or whatever to see if they have the thing when spinach and lettuce were contaminated with salmonella. And this was like, we're going back maybe about 3 years ago, but it's a huge thing in the United States. And I wonder if they talk about how, you know, some people who eat spinach have allergic reactions and how terrible it is. Oh, and by the way, it's salmonella recall. I mean, you're right. This is such a biased propaganda type thing. And it's hard to read news sometimes and find out what is the news in it when some authors have agendas. We obviously never have an agenda because we're skeptics and we're perfect people. But
well, I mean, the idea whether people who write supposedly unbiased newspaper articles have agendas is a topic for a much longer broadcast.
But they might just be trying to get, you know, their article in print, and a fancy headline is more than
they're trying to make a narrative out of something that they might think is boring. Well, but not to pan on the Vancouver Sun. Their health section has pretty good articles in it as well.
Please don't sue us.
Yeah. But the other story I found this week was a study of vaccination being done on Hutterite colonies in Western Canada and the sort of northern climes.
Did you do Hutterite colonies?
Hutterite.
What are Hutterite colonies?
They're colonies of people who are Hutterites.
That explains that.
Actually, I can tell you this because growing up on the prairies in Manitoba, Hutterites are a big thing. They're a communal, quasi-religious group. I'm not sure exactly, but they're from Germany. Originally, and they're like Amish.
They're roughly
like technology.
They're roughly equivalent to Pennsylvania Dutch, as far as I know. But
sure.
That's something for someone to confirm.
But I didn't realize that they were looking at a vaccine to cure Hutterite.
No. They were looking at flu vaccinations, and what they did was they vaccinated kids from 3 to 15 year old with flu shots that were to reduce the incidence of flu, and they found that it actually reduced the incidence of flu by 60% among those who were not vaccinated, as well as the children.
So then what you're saying, Rob, is that the flu is possibly caused by some kind of infectious agent that can spread to different people.
Well, the thing that's interesting about this is that this was published a couple weeks ago in the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. So it's a pretty strong journal. But basically, this is a massive study that proves that vaccination works, and it also finds a way of making it work via herd immunity by just immunizing children.
Rob, is there a chance this is related to the whooping cough outbreak a couple of months ago that I believe involved the same group of people. A lot of isolated communities that, for whatever reason, you know, spur medical technology.
Well, sorry, I'm going to jump in here right now just to defend, because my parents live in the back in the prairies and they don't want to be beat up by Hutterites. Hutterites don't spur technology. What they do, and why this is a good example, is they live in communes and they tend to be separate and they tend to be simple, as in they're not, you know, they're not fancy, they don't drive big cars, although they do drive pretty big trucks if you've ever seen them. So this wouldn't have anything to do with people who are averse to technology or anything like that. But it's a good, because again, they live in secluded, so you have a control, it's very easy to control the environment of the children that in this thing. So no, it has nothing to do with whooping cough.
They're useful as a scientific group for studying, I suppose. But I mean, obviously, they were vaccinating against flu, and also the control group was vaccinating against Hep A, I believe, which often has outbreaks in Hutterite communities that are isolated. So it's not like they were doing things just to study them. They also try to help them via the methods of the study. But the thing that I found was really interesting about this was that it's a huge study. They had about 1,000 kids, 500 in each group, and on top of that, 2,300 community members who weren't among the vaccinated groups. And basically, they found that, you know, as I said, it reduced the incidence of flu among those who were not vaccinated by 60%, and they sort of extrapolated and figured that herd immunity can be achieved in a regular population by immunizing about 80% of school children in the population.
Any numbers on how many of the vaccinated children developed autism?
Probably none, given what we know about that spurious connection. But the thing that was interesting here was that the current vaccination policy in the Canadian Medical Association here, and the one that was used for the H1N1 outbreak, was to vaccinate healthy children over the age of 5 last. They were the very last people to be vaccinated. And this study shows pretty well and pretty strongly that might not be the best strategy to go to if you want herd immunity. So they got a quote from the Public Health Agency of Canada, and they said that they followed available evidence when they were doing the vaccination schedule for H1N1, but they will reevaluate evidence every time there's a new outbreak, which is the scientific thing to do. You reevaluate the evidence. Here's a new study that shows that vaccinating the kids will help you get herd immunity. Next time there's an outbreak, hopefully that's what they're going to do.
That actually reminds me of something that I did some research when the H1N1 was a big thing. And one of the things that had come up was when they do vaccines, they tend to vaccinate the most vulnerable in society. Unfortunately, those also tend to be the people who are least likely to get immunity, because their systems are their weak systems. By definition, they're not functioning all well. And that some scientists were suggesting that they should do more research into vaccinating the more mobile in a society to get this herd immunity. So you vaccinate the healthy, and although they don't necessarily need it in themselves, if they no longer are transmitters of the disease, you by default protect those who are weaker.
Yeah, there was something similar I remember about a guy who was studying how social networks facilitate the spread of things like disease, but also obesity and friendliness and social helping, and suggested that you vaccinate the people that come in contact with a lot of other people. In this case, that would be school children, because they go to the schoolhouse, come in contact with a lot of other kids who then go to their families and infect their parents, and voila, you have an outbreak.
I noticed, going back to Ethan's comment about autism, whatever, that, what was it, Jenny McCarthy has written an article in the Huffington Post, which I heard on the SGU, where, because last week, if you remember, we were talking a bit about how Hollywood Now, or one of the Hollywood gossip rags, was saying that Jenny McCarthy's kind of backed off a bit on her claims about autism and vaccination.
And it turned out that was complete bullshit.
Well, no, exactly, because she apparently wrote this article for the Huffington Post, and I really lose respect for Huffington Post for having published her article, but free speech is free speech, I guess.
How can you lose respect for the Huffington Post? I mean, I lost respect for them eons ago,
okay.
When they got Deepak Chopra as a major contributor.
Yeah, okay. But the big thing is, I mean, not only does she lie in the thing, saying there's so many repeatable studies that have shown it to be true, but, I mean, Wakefield, who we've vilified a number of times, she still says, no, it's all a conspiracy out to get him and everything like that. It just... Oh, well.
It's very frustrating, isn't it?
It's all about the communication between patients and doctors, and that's, you know, there's obviously problems with that, that patients and the general public don't have a good idea of how the medical profession works and how vaccinations work, and doctors have trouble talking to their patients, which, incidentally, is our large segment when we come back.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure... Remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeehaw!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. And we're talking about doctors and the relationship and presenting information to their patients. So what's going on about that, Rob?
So there's been quite a lot of studies recently related to this topic, which is kind of why I compiled them all together in one place so we could talk about it on the show. But basically... The Canadian Medical Association has basically started promoting the idea that patients should be unafraid to question their doctors and to ask for a second opinion. Because doctors are people, they can make mistakes. And when you have a very difficult decision to make, you know, pending, you know, like, oh, the doctor tells you you have cancer, well, you should get a second opinion. Not only because maybe you're hoping that the doctor was wrong, but because it's helpful and stronger to corroborate an opinion like that. So in the article, which we'll put up on our show notes, they talk about how there's women who get mastectomies with, you know, even though they didn't have breast cancer, or chemotherapy, even though they didn't need it, and basically talking about how doctors do misread results. They misread charts, they misread biopsy results, they'll report information that they got from the lab when someone else at the lab made a mistake. So it is important, it is necessary for the patient to understand that doctors are not infallible practitioners of, you know, health gods or something. You are allowed to question them.
Well, isn't the difficulty, though, with that is a lot of times if you have a if you're concerned about cancer, getting an appointment to see a doctor for cancer screening is often, you know, a 3-month wait, that if you want to get a second opinion, it could be, you know, detrimental to your health.
That is a possible risk. I'm not sure actually how long it takes to schedule second opinions, but I mean, the possibility is there. The fact that people are taking the doctor's word as completely solid leads to problems like this. And actually, they did an inquiry, the government, I believe, found that hundreds of test results at this one pathology lab between 1997 and 2005 were incorrect, completely incorrect. Although I note that the article doesn't list the full number, so we don't have an idea of the base incidence rate of errors, and they don't mention the false positive or false negative rates of the tests they were looking at. But the point still stands. Tests are wrong, doctors can be wrong, patients should question it. Actually, the Best Doctors Canada Association estimates that there's a 22% error rate in what doctors tell patients, and nearly 50% for some cancers.
There's two things, actually, I was thinking with regards to this. One, I mean, isn't there a certain risk that I sit there and I'm going to go and I'm going to look on the internet and I'm going to read up all about this stuff about medical. I'm going to go to the doctor. Doctor's going to say something. And I'm not going to believe what he says because of the quote-unquote information I got from the web, where that information can be. I mean, you might question your doctor, but doesn't that lead a certain risk where you're trying to prescribe for yourself where you may not actually have the wherewithal where a doctor would?
Well, I mean, you shouldn't self-diagnose. You shouldn't try to prescribe yourself medicine. You should, to a certain extent, trust that the doctor has more experience with medicine than you do. However, as you know, the inquiry and the estimates from Best Docs Canada indicate, doctors do make mistakes. It is a good idea, like in both of these situations, whether you're talking to a doctor or looking at medical information online, you have to keep in mind that information isn't always reliable. So in, it's not like you should hold one as a stronger source than the other. You should hold both up to the same scrutiny that any good skeptic would hold any source of information to.
So then would you want to say to your doctor, you know, Dr. Rob, I appreciate your diagnosis that I have cancer. I want a second opinion. Can you recommend somebody?
Yeah.
Or do you say, you know, okay, thanks, I'm going to go find somebody on my own? Because if you go and find someone on your own, you do run the risk of falling prey to, you know, the numerous con artists out there who make their living, you know, tricking people who have a serious illness.
You should be able to trust your doctor enough to tell them to their face that, look, this is an extremely difficult diagnosis. I'd like to make sure, you know, and please recommend someone who you know is an expert at this.
So I think it's clear what Rob is saying here. Rob isn't saying that doctors are crooks and they're out to screw you around.
Quack doctors are.
Yeah, they're human and they make mistakes, and they know that they can make mistakes. And actually, going with one of the questions that Ethan had mentioned earlier, that, you know, if I got cancer, do I want to wait another 6 months to see that? I think once you've been given the diagnosis of having something like cancer, you get fast-tracked on a lot of these waiting lists. So if you did want a second opinion, I do think it's not like you'd have to wait another 6 months to go see the doctor. They'd get you in quickly because, well, theoretically, they don't want you to die.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if they really would fast-track you. I think their opinion would be like on a cost-benefit analysis.
No. You're thinking the American healthcare system, which is very different. That's where you have the death panels set up by insurance companies, as opposed to Canada, where they're actually kind of more or less worried about your health. It's only when you get above the doctor that it starts getting to those, how many surgeries can we schedule in this year?
Well, you know, the triage system will put you in waiting lines.
In the American system, no. You pay money, you get it. But with the Canadian system, if everyone started getting second opinions on major things, our healthcare system's already strained. It's just going to get overloaded. For doctors to make a diagnosis, it takes time. And no, to get a second
opinion. Not to get second opinions on everything, but I mean, there's a flip side to this. You have the right, and you should be able to ask your doctor questions about how they made the diagnosis, the results that they got, and the possibility of getting second opinion. But the doctor also has to tell you what the results mean. He has to interpret them correctly with the statistics involved and make sure that you understand, like, yeah, this test means that there is a 90% chance that you actually have cancer. Well, which, then, you know,
what if the system was designed so that, you know, suppose you make an appointment to see your doctor, you say, I think I have cancer. The doctor says, okay, there's probably a good chance you have cancer. So included in that appointment is your initial consultation and your initial test, followed by a second opinion by a different doctor, maybe at the same hospital, maybe not, so that you automatically have that second opinion.
Well, I know in my own case, because I had surgery done on my gastric system, and I know I went to my GP, mm-hmm. and then I went to a specialist, and then I went to the surgeon, and each one of those did their own assessment of the condition at the time. And going on with what Daniel had said, a lot of the quote-unquote disaster of our healthcare system or overworking our health system is actually very skewed. There are some areas where there's very long lineups, but 90% of the area doesn't have that. I had a friend of mine who had surgery in less than 3 months from going into the doctor saying, hey, I've got a funny lump, can you get rid of it? They said, okay, no problem, and boom, got rid of it. So,
Well, I'd also think that, you know, if we were able to invest a bit more in our healthcare system, you know, if all of a sudden we had a huge spike in, say, cancer patients, you know, I think that it might be wise to sort of maybe invest a bit more, maybe open up a few more cancer treatment centers, as opposed to just sort of going, well, the system's broke, let's redesign it. You know, maybe put a bit more into the basket.
There's all sorts of possible solutions and possible problems to fix. But, I mean, there's actually, like, talking about Canada and the U.S., this is a problem of patient-doctor communication that happens all over the world. And New York actually recently tried a program designed to increase communication and compliance between doctors and patients called Ask Me 3. And the idea was that the patient would come in and ask during the session, the doctor, three questions. What's the main problem? What do I need to do about it? And why is it important that I do this? Now, so they separated into two groups. There were medical practices that promoted this with posters and pamphlets and doctors being reminded about it and stuff, and one group that kept on carrying on as normal. The study actually found that there were no major differences, but it was a weirdly skewed sample that had unusually high questioning rate in both groups. So in both areas, the subjects would ask a way higher than normal amount of questions to the doctors. But they did find that the group with the Ask Me 3 promotion had better memory of lifestyle changes that the doctors had recommended to them. So this sort of, I thought, dovetailed nicely with the way that naturopathic doctors are always talking about, like, we don't just treat the symptoms, we treat the disease by recommending lifestyle changes and diet things and exercise to the patient. Well, turns out doctors actually do that, but people don't tend to remember, except when, for example, they're in this kind of situation where they promote the doctor-patient communication.
So you might get an askew if you go to, quote-unquote, the homeopath, whatever, and they recommend lifestyle changes. Because they're not actually giving you any real medical advice, you tend to remember the lifestyle changes. Whereas if you go to a doctor who's actually giving you real medical advice, the lifestyle changes will tend to be secondary on your list because he's saying, take this drug to live as opposed to drink this water because it makes me money.
Yeah. So the authors of this study said that they need to redo it and check with by focusing specifically on groups of people that have low communication with their doctor. That makes sense to me.
You know, there is one. I mean, we've been talking about cancer, which really is, you know, I mean, it's a big thing, right? But what about the kind of things, you know, when you go to the doctor and you've read in the newspaper or something about mega dosing on vitamins or something like that, you know, and the doctor says, well, no, you know, if you take 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C, you're just gonna urinate most of that away, or maybe you should take this supplement, and you go to the store and they've got the echinacea or something you should buy. I mean, you know, where does that play into the doctor-patient relationship, you guys think?
Actually, patients often don't tell the doc about vitamins and supplements they're taking, especially when their kids are taking them. Because when your kid goes into the doctor's office, you go with them and you're sort of responsible for making sure the doc knows all the stuff that your kid is taking. And often parents won't either remember or just won't think it's important to tell the doctor about vitamins and supplements. Well, there may be interactions and there may be adverse side effects of megadosing with vitamins, and the doctors need to know about them. So they actually did a study, which they say is the first large-scale study of vitamin use in, you know, patients and whether they tell their doctors. And they studied about 1,800 kids. Nearly 600 of them took vitamins daily or weekly, and others more took them on occasionally. But only 35% of them did it on the doctor's recommendation, and most of them didn't actually tell their doctors that they were doing this via their parents. So a lot of the time, and this study was done or at least commented on by Dr. Goldman here at UBC, and also the director of emergency medicine at the BC Children's Hospital, and found that kids with chronic diseases like asthma or cancer or diabetes accounted for about one-third of it because parents, and this is a quote, parents tend to want to boost their immune systems. And I sort of read this and like, wow, that is one of the major things that naturopaths constantly harp on. Boost your immune system. This supplement will boost your immune system. Take this vitamin, it's going to boost your immune system. So, I mean, I thought this was, it's sort of anecdotal, but it seems to me like it seems like these naturopathic ads and vitamin ads and supplement ads are basically misinforming the public to seem to think that boosting your immune system is a good idea.
Well, no. Boosting your immune system is a good idea. It's the idea that this is the way to do it.
No, I mean, boosting your immune system is a misnomer. It doesn't actually mean anything.
Exactly.
I mean, I found another study this week when I was, and it's scientists have actually figured out a major purpose of vitamin D. We've known for a while that vitamin D helps you absorb calcium, but Danish researchers found that T cells, which are kind of a cell that fights off diseases in your immune system, rely on vitamin D to become active, and they remain dormant and unable to recognize diseases. and infections if you have low amounts of vitamin D in your bloodstream. So you get vitamin D by sun tanning, by eating fatty fish oil, or eggs, or things like that. But it's important to note, and this is one of the examples of how a vitamin can interact with your treatments. So in this case, vitamin D does actually boost your immune system, and I use, you know, scare quotes around that. But basically what it does is allow your T cells to activate and fight off disease. But this is extremely dangerous, for example, for autoimmune diseases. If you have too much vitamin D in your system and you have an autoimmune disease, both of those things work by constantly causing your T cells to multiply like crazy, and then they start attacking your own cells, your own muscles, your own organs. Or in another case where this is important is during an organ transplant. The biggest danger during an organ transplant is the recipient's own immune system trying to fight off and kill this intruder to the body, which is the donated organ. And if you have been taking a lot of vitamin D, you're going to have a lot of immune cells that are going to cause problems.
Are a lot of patients of these things taking vitamin D? Is there a study out there that's looked into this?
Or? Well, that's just it. No one looks into it. Doctors don't remember to ask. Patients and, you know, kids' parents don't tell the doctors if they're taking vitamin supplements. And I'm sure that there have been cases where this has led to problems. So it's good that there's been a study that looks into it. And now we just need to make sure that patients and doctors communicate and question each other.
So I guess the conclusion being here that we need to increase the communication between doctors, patients, and we need to educate people on the question they should be asking their doctors.
Exactly, and to educate people to understand that the claims being made, you know, in advertising by naturopaths and, you know, newspapers aren't always accurate.
Well, why don't we start this wrap-up, because we're out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. A couple of events, skeptical highlights to promote. Big one tonight, Skeptics in the Pub, 7:30 at the Railway Club. Be there or be square.
I discovered this, and I'm not recommending this, but I think it's very interesting that it's being done. It's called Hidden Monsters, the Unidentified Creatures in BC. It's being held this Thursday, March 18th, 7 p.m. at the Welsh Hall, which I believe is in West Vancouver. And basically what it is, it's cryptozoology. It's discussing the Sasquatch, Opinoco, and all the other hidden creatures that's supposed to be in the backgrounds of BC. I don't know. If you didn't like the latest movie, you want some entertainment, maybe this could be an interesting thing to go.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So if anyone goes to see that, let us know. It sounds like an interesting thing to cover.
There's another thing happening just before Skeptics in the Pub tonight, as I recall.
Oh, right. Yes. CFI is holding a sort of casual talk on organizing some workshops for the average skeptic out there. Workshops in you know, designed to say how to write to your local newspaper, how to get on as a columnist in your university newspaper. So like Daniel, for instance, how to become a columnist for the UBC newspaper.
Are you trying to pressure me into something here?
No,
do it.
No, I'm not. But speaking of CFI, we actually have an event coming up on March 26th. It's a talk by Pat O'Brien, who's been a well-known humanist and skeptic in Vancouver for a long time. And his talk is called, Why'd You Have to Go and Make Things So Complicated? All about the skeptical community and the way we talk to the general public.
Aren't those lyrics to some song?
Maybe. And then
not one that any of us have heard ever.
Yes. That talk will be at UBC, and stay tuned for the room number and check out www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver for the details.
Speaking of talks at UBC, Vancouver Skeptic Camp is coming up. And Radio Freethink will be there, and that's coming up on March 20th, which is this Saturday, I believe.
Yes.
And we'll be giving a sort of a group talk where each of us will do our own thing for 7 or so minutes, and you should come see us and come see some of the many other really cool speakers that are planned.
Please do check out the webpage and register to get a good deal on the kick-ass t-shirt that Skeptic Camp is releasing. I have seen these t-shirts. They are easily the coolest t-shirts ever created. in the history of the universe.
Wow.
we should point out, too, if I remember correctly, that Radio Free Thinker is part sponsor of this Skepticam.
That's right. So you'll get the awesome Radio Free Thinker logo on your T-shirt.
Which is a collector's item, because I do believe it's the first time our logo has been on a T-shirt. So buy a lot of them, store them up. I am sure they will be big money item, collector items in the years to come.
Maybe or we'll if not, you can them. You can buy them up, store them up, and use them as dish rags later in life.
Maybe. Well, anyway, let's close up the show. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying, mind's eyes open, mind's on.
Uh-huh.
I say it every week, like I screw up.
This is Rob saying, have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying, thanks for listening.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9.